Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Carl.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
We're back. Today is George Jetson's birthday. Can you believe it? George Jetson, born on this day. This is the future. Apparently, but sadly, Eric Greitens is not going to be in it. Now, we try not to get too political on this show because the whole system is rotten. But We're gonna touch on this human paraquat was a governor, and keep in mind there's about 50,000 child brides a year that come out of Missouri. So y'all keep that in mind whenever we do this clip 463. Mike, hit it.
Talk about is a bill to provide VA benefits to soldiers who served in our military, two veterans, I just want to be clear who we're talking about here, who were exposed to toxic substances, who were exposed to toxins, and who got sick as a result of it. And a lot of this relates particularly to burn pits and a lot of the data that's coming out of burn pits and a lot of the information about soldiers developing serious illnesses and dying and cancers because of exposure to burn pits.
Ben, it's a recurring theme, Ben. Like, they do this all the time. They do this with our veterans every single time that they're in need of help. The Democrats are there to give them the benefits that they need, to give them the care that they need. These people, many of them gave their lives for our country. Many of them gave their health for their country. They are suffering every single day. And the least that we could do for them is to help them with their health care and to help them not have to suffer every single day. And this is something that John Stewart has championed so much with 9/11, that the first Republicans were against also. I mean, this goes back. The 9/11 first responders still cannot get benefits because of the Republicans. Think about that.
We're back. And everybody remembers when we first rolled on the scene.
Well, I'm no career politician. I'm a Navy SEAL, and I'll take dead aim at politics as usual. Everyone also remembers that because I fought for you, they came after me. Well, we're back, wiser, stronger, still fighting, and this time with an army of patriots.
Good evening. In 1988, Missourians passed a constitutional amendment that allows the General Assembly to conduct a special session when it deems necessary. For the first time in the history of our state, the General Assembly has initiated this constitutional provision. Just a few minutes ago, a petition was delivered to the Secretary of State calling the General Assembly into a special session beginning on May 18th. This was not a decision made lightly, and certainly not without great deliberation and effort. As everyone knows, it requires the signatures of 3/4 of the members of the House and 3/4 of the members of the Senate. Regretfully, the call of this historic act is for the sole purpose to consider the findings and recommendation of the House committee, including disciplinary actions against Governor Greitens.
Good evening, Mike. We are right in front of the front doors of the governor's office where he made that statement to reporters 45 minutes ago, trying to get ahead of the release of this report by the legislative committee. This entire hallway, full of press, dozens and dozens of members of the press, and they were just crushing into that room, an entire room of people waiting to hear what the governor had to say. He stood in front of all of those people, made about a 5 to 10 minute statement. He did not take a single question. Questions were shouted at him, but as soon as he was done, he turned on his heel and he was out of there, back into his private office. So how did we get here? Let's kind of go through the timeline of how this all began. So it took more than 2 years for the affair to surface, but less than 2 months for that indictment. On January 10th, an audio recording was released. In it, the governor's apparent mistress claimed to her ex-husband that Greitens blackmailed her to keep quiet about the relationship. Greitens confirmed the affair. He denied the blackmail. The next day, a St. Louis Circuit Attorney, Kim Gardner, she launched a criminal investigation. And then on February 22nd, the governor was indicted and booked on a felony invasion of privacy charge. After the indictment, a special House committee was formed to investigate those allegations. That committee has been meeting since March 6th, mostly behind closed doors, sometimes off-site. The latest meeting was about 5 hours ago here at the state capitol. House Minority Leader Gail McCann Betty from Kansas City, she is already calling for Greitens to step down. In a statement released a little more than an hour ago, she says, "For the good of the state, Eric Greitens must immediately resign. If he doesn't, it will be the duty of the House of Representatives to restore integrity to the executive branch of state government." The governor talked to reporters, like I said, about 45 minutes ago, and it does not sound like he's quitting.
I want to say again what I've said from the beginning. This is a political witch hunt. In just 33 days, a court of law and a jury of my peers will let every person in Missouri know the truth and prove my innocence. In 33 days, this witch hunt will come to an end.
The governor used those words, witch hunt, over and over again during his brief statement. He even compared this to the witch hunts, he says, are going on in Washington, D.C. My colleague, Casey Nolan, he's upstairs right now with the latest on this report. Casey?
Yeah, and what we're inside the House chamber right now. This is where we're setting up to hear from the leadership of the House, Republican leadership, fellow Republicans to the governor. That's expected at about 6 o'clock. In the meantime, we are going through the report, as you said, so just kind of bear with me here. This is Sam Clancy with KSDK.com. He's helping us out. I think maybe the first thing to mention here, this kind of is obviously what the guy's trying to get out ahead of here. This is the report opens with this, a sensitive content warning. The report contains content of a sensitive and sexual nature. The House Special Investigative Committee on Oversight has kept descriptions of an adult nature and coarse language in order to provide an unfiltered record of witness testimony. In some cases, the identities of the witness and sensitive information have been redacted. So a couple of the things. So I think it's worth saying that obviously we're on live TV. We're kind of taking this in as we go. We obviously have to be careful with what we go through as well. So just a couple of things that I think would be pertinent, perhaps without the salaciousness. One thing that we have been hearing throughout the day that is in the report indeed, and that goes to the credibility of the witness being the woman with whom the governor has admitted to having an affair. The committee, just under the signatures on this report, says that they find this witness to be overall a credible witness. We were told that that was a unanimous decision. I don't have that in front of me right here, but that nevertheless, the report starts out with saying that she is credible. And Sam, you were telling me it also they have character witnesses for the witness as well. Two people who've known the woman for a combined 40 years is also who they brought in. Then we skip ahead a little bit, and she starts to describe the incident in question. The governor is accused of taking this photo without her consent. So at some point they're in allegedly in the basement of the governor's then Central West End residence when they went into the basement for some sort of a workout. It was the pretense, according to these allegations. She says, before you start a workout, you have to be hydrated. And the governor, according to this witness, puts water in his mouth and tries to spit it into my mouth, at which point I realize he's trying to kiss me, but I don't want to kiss him. And then it kind of goes into further details there as well. Again, I don't know that all of this, without a little bit more review, we should just read on the air verbatim. So I'll refrain from that. But nevertheless, it's the idea that, according to this witness, according to the woman at the center of this affair that the governor has admitted to from 2015, before he was in office, she's saying that he's trying to kiss her without her permission. It goes on to say other things as well that I think we should probably go through a little more carefully before we disseminate.
My wounded out of there in the hospital in 15 minutes. I want my men out.
Somebody stay in there tight with Big Duke.
This is Cat Tower. We're going to be in Dharma to get out. So the spear is our way in.
Take the side. ground, trying to put it down here.
Right, 1-3, you were fixing to fuck with him. What target?
I'm gonna press the mortar fire off the tree line down there.
Roger, here we go.
Good, give it all you got, bring in all your ships. Wing of breath.
Man, about to be my chopper! Get him back to the hospital! Go! No, 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 no! You gotta go with him! Come on, go! Go! Get it out of here! And tell my guys I'm on my board!
Big up 6, this is Sub-1-3. The jet's being by now. There, you got about 30 seconds to on station. Get your people back and head down. This is gonna be a big one.
We'll have this place cleaned up and ready to jimmy, son. Don't you worry.
Give me those shorts.
Mission with the air cam. Trust it for me and the boys. I want to see you do your stuff in them. Out there. Okay?
We're back with Vixen Vendetta coming after Eric, the Eric Greitens, the man history forgot in about 2 days. Hasta la vista, Eric Greitens, and we're coming after you. We're coming after all the evangelicals. We're going to meet you at Pottawatomie Creek like John Brown did with his broadsword, if you catch my drift. Beer's going to flow and blood's going to fill, going to spill. This next one, we're going to go back into Christian identity because it's that time of year. We're coming after the evangelicals. 475. Hit it, Mike.
So can the Bill of Rights protect a person that's been violated by this dark side of religion? Does the Bill of Rights protect the dark side of religion, the First Amendment? Is an individual free to give up his freedom of thought? I think not.
What can be done on a societal and political level?
The best thing to do would be terribly strong, but we've made some progress in it. And that would be to take the overt violations of the fundamentalists, like in the Assembly of God, where they have taken their youth group and ministers, the Assembly of God ministers, have made homosexuals out of the boys in this youth group. The group's called the Royal Rangers. And our court case in California was settled several months ago. The Assembly of God ministers were guilty to the tune of $1.75 million. This money then was paid to the parents of the children who were molested.
Good Lord.
But the important thing is the lawsuit was against the church and not the minister. This means that the members of the Assembly of God Church were liable for the action of the minister. So if we can continue this thinking and make people that are snapped by the fundamentalists to make the congregation liable for that, we've never lost a suit on any psychological basis for improper counseling. There's been many of those, and the fundamentalist churches have always lost because of improper counseling on people. When those lawsuits then get back to the individual church member, then I think there will be a great straightening out of the low, call them black churches.
Mm-hmm. But you're still going to have that stratum up above where the people, the Christian coalition, are interlocked with the military-industrial complex, and they have their various structures of power up at the top, and with the ability to raise tremendous amounts of money to continue this this drive for power and counter-revolution.
Well, if the class action suit works against the fundamentalists, it might well work against the Christian coalition.
Yeah. feel degraded too as a member of the human race. Tom, can you first give a case history? Kind of a typical case history, and then we'll talk in greater detail about what happens.
I can tell you the biography of a little kid from a hollow in West Virginia.
There was one guy that picked me up in Atlanta, and he just said that, you know, he wanted somebody to go out and have a few beers with him and smoke a joint. And we got over there, and I was drinking this beer, and all of a sudden, you know, doing like that, you know, I couldn't even see straight. My eyes were rolling back, and then the room started spinning, and I was out of it. When I came around, he had me tied up in the basement, no less. Way up like this, you know, and I couldn't even move.
And you tied up?
Yeah, stretched.
What was he doing to you?
Nothing. He was just sitting there with this whip looking like he was going to hit me with it. He just threatened me a lot, and I was sitting there crying, scared to death, you know, because the worst they could do is kill me, you know.
That interview was conducted several months ago in Houston, Texas. Investigators now fear that the 15-year-old is dead. The body of a young man found ritualistically dismembered in Missouri is thought to be his.
I woke up, and he was clamping handcuffs on me. I was laying on my stomach. The other two were on their stomach, and they were handcuffed, and their feet were tied.
The most shocking and horrifying result of older men having sex with young boys is the story of Dean Corll in Houston, Texas, and more recently, John Gacy in Chicago. In Houston, Corll lured or had brought to his home at least 27 young boys, all under the age of 17. The boys were sexually assaulted, then killed.
In Houston, I give the figure based on, I think, prudent calculations that upwards of 350 boys a year are killed deliberately because of this. Many more die of drug overuse, malnutrition, of suicide. The national toll per year is in the thousands every year. Kids die violently because of this. In the first 3 months of this year, 1981, 30 boys were found dead in Houston. None of them was called a homicide. They were found to be dead of exposure, dead of causes undetermined, dead of massive internal bleeding, as in the case of one child under 10 who was found naked in a Dempsey dumpster with his colon and his rectum torn apart. He was called not a homicide, but a victim of massive internal injury.
In our previous program, the first section of this two-part series on boys for sale, the widespread use and abuse of youth for the gratification of various men around the country, we talked about the general nature, who's involved, what kids, where they come from, how they get involved in it, the nature of the men themselves, the ages, the fact that they come from the highest, the socioeconomic and political stratum of the American society, the fact that this is a very widespread thing and that it is hushed up generally, and it's extremely violent. Kids are killed, many kids are killed and tortured every year, as well as abused. Tom Philpott is still with us, history professor at the University of Texas. Mark McKinnon, former editor of the Daily Texan.
Investigations in other cities have shown that boys 13, 14, even younger, are coerced into prostitution with threats of physical violence and are sometimes shipped across state lines, shipped to the older adult men who desire young boys for sexual acts. Occasionally, these boys' episodes with their older clients ends in physical violence. There are men who seek young boys to torture and sometimes to kill.
The President's Commission on Obscenity found, this is the commission that Richard Nixon repudiated, it mentioned in passing that child pornography was a phenomenon of the abuse of children, and then went on to say that for every female prostitute of any age in the United States, there are 9 boys underage who are prostitutes. And there was a call boy ring operated out of New York City, which had phone hookups with Houston, Atlanta, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Washington, D.C. And that call boy ring had a list of 10,000 clients who could call and with a credit card purchase a boy.
Hello. Hello, this is credit card number 06789. I'd like to make an order, please.
Go ahead.
I'm looking for a young male, blonde hair, blue eyes.
Body hair or no body hair?
Thick body hair, please.
What age?
10 to 12.
Butch or femme?
Butch, please.
What is your address?
I'm at the Houston Marriott Hotel, room 313.
Wire me $200 now by credit card, and have $100 in cash for the boy. He'll be there in 30 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
But it is not a matter of gay rights as advocated by practically anybody. This is a much different sort of phenomenon. The reason that the gay community usually scorns any investigation of the subject is that they know that the average person in the public will blame homosexuals and homosexuality for the phenomenon, regardless of what facts are presented.
The kind of individuals involved are down the line, almost in every instance, in the cases I've investigated, men who are very powerful, usually very wealthy, and usually administrate control over a large number of people. You know, the Sex Crimes Division is a subset of Vice.
No, it's part of homicide in almost every city.
Oh, is it?
It's part of homicide. Vice has to do with pornography, obscenity, prostitution, things involving consenting adults, which may be crimes if they're performed in public or commercially. A sex crime is something that involves a direct violation of the law or involves things with kids or child pornography.
At that time, they had three people in the entire sex crimes division, and they were so overworked with just, you know, that's when the choker rapist was around and what have you, and I mean, that pretty much exhausts their time. And they were concerned about the issue, but they just said, frankly, we're not staffed, we don't have the personnel to do it.
Well, rape is a major crime. The incidence is high. Attempted rape is common. It's extremely hard to track down a rapist. These guys are working extremely hard, and then we charge them with the duty of cleaning up the streets. And in Austin, the streets are clean. In Houston, they're not. How can they go behind the walls and find out what's going on indoors? That's extremely hard to do. There have been legislative investigations. There was a national investigation a couple of years ago looking toward the goal of national legislation to protect kids. But no, there hasn't been much.
There are some who would like to tell us that the problem does not exist. But to say Houston is a major center for boy, 16-year-old boy came to us telling how he'd started as a prostitute at age 12 and now is employed by a large Houston corporation. The corporation pays him from a well-covered slush fund.
I'm working right now, you know, like, just, you know, with the corporation. And
what's that? How's that work?
Well, when their executives or, you know, their business people are in town, they're sent to our apartment, and we entertain them while they're here.
Okay, what's that entertainment usually involve? What do they usually demand, or what do they want?
Well, it's all kinds of sex and perversions. There's no two alike. I've decided that.
Subsequent to the making of this interview, this boy's mutilated body was found.
It's closely attached to the major financial, commercial, industrial, educational institutions of our society. It's run by the same people who run those. It's frequented by the same people who occupy management positions in those. It's not the mafia. It's an adjunct of clean business. It's serving the most respectable people we have in our society, the people who are the elite.
Yeah. the idea was to get behind some of the stories we've been hearing during the months preceding about the fantastically expensive hardware, the $1,000 wrenches, the $6,000 coffee pots, and so forth. I obtained a copy of the budget of the Pentagon and leafed through the sections detailing research and development and procurement programs, the budgets for buying new weapons. There are blank spaces, hundreds of them, where dollar figures should be. There were code words where descriptions or names of programs should be. I began talking to people inside and outside of the Pentagon, and they identified this as a problem in a kind of a tug of war between secrecy and democracy. I don't mean to overdramatize it, but that spring things were getting out of hand in Washington. And you had an atmosphere that secrecy was winning. The folks I talked to focused my attention on the black budget, and I went to work. The editor of the newspaper, who's sadly left us recently, Gene Roberts, was very intrigued by the notion. It wasn't something that was being directly addressed, and he wanted me to dig up as much as I could and get it in the paper. Before I had assembled enough to write about, Iran-Contra broke that fall. And so the context of excessive secrecy was now something that was on the public agenda. I started work for the Inquirer in 1982. So most of that time was digging into corruption in HUD programs, corruption in the Philadelphia Police Department. And I'd just returned from 4 months in the Philippines covering the Marcos and Aquino contest. My dad's field is psychosomatic medicine, and my mom's is history. Started out working three jobs simultaneously in New York, based in the federal and state courts there, down in Foley Square. And this is where I learned my love of documents. When you interview people as a reporter, sometimes they will lie. Sometimes they will equivocate or shade their speech to suit a private agenda, but the document, like the lawyers say, speaks for itself. The idea of digging in the stacks for the document that contains the seed of fact is integral to good journalism. The idea of coming up with words on paper or facts on file that will give you the underpinnings, the historical basis for writing good interpretive analytical work, that started in college. That started in the stacks. A group of us at the Kansas City Times shared a Pulitzer in 1982 for uncovering the causes of the Hyatt Hotel disaster that happened in the summer of 1981, the collapse of the skywalks in a brand new hotel that killed 114 people. So that was a shared one. And then these stories that formed the basis of Blank Check were given the Pulitzer for National Reporting in 1988.
All right. We're back. I don't know if I'm in the green room or if I'm live. 7:48 p.m.
You're live. You're live, brother. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Jesus. Well, I'll tell you what, while we're hacking these religious right evangelicals down, we might as well keep this rally going. So that was Scarlet Riot from the UK, played a couple songs, and the last song was by The Warning from Monterrey, Mexico. They're going to be in St. Louis in September. I highly suggest everybody catch at least one heavy metal show every decade or so, just to keep up with what's going on. And there's more great musicians out there now than any time in history, which is maybe one of the saving graces, because we need some R&R since these past 40 years, and we just got to push on. That's all I can say, folks. 461, Mike. Hit it.
The United Nations, which for 25 years was a silly joke, suddenly is going to rule the world. And that we're to cede the sovereignty of America to this organization that voted against our interests 85% of the time from its inception till the Gulf War. And we say, what is happening in the world? And into that void steps an organization called the Christian Coalition. We want, ladies and gentlemen, as soon as possible, to see a working majority of the Republican Party in the hands of pro-family Christians by 1996 or sooner. We want to strive for the election of a conservative pro-family majority in the United States House of Representatives by 1996. Next, of course, we want to see the White House in pro-family Christian hands, at least by the year 2000 or sooner. We're going to come back this year. We're going to come back in 93. We'll be there again in 94. We'll be there again in 95 and 96 and 97 and 98 and 99. We're going to keep coming back till we win it all.
The problem is when they get so wild-eyed that they want to actually murder people and kill people. The current religious right has a term. They have their own vocabulary. One of their words is pregatory prayer. Pregatory. It's not in the dictionary, but it's a word. It's a big word. It means, in the religious right term, that when they pray that a person be changed against abortion or whatever, if that person is not converted, then they have a right, a God-given right, to execute God's judgment upon that person. So, which of course means to kill them.
They said there was only one solution to these moral problems. America needed to be a nation ruled by Christian principles. The Bible, not the Constitution, was the supreme law of the land.
I pledge allegiance to the Christian flag and to the Savior for whose kingdom it stands.
It began from a high vantage point under a money-making scheme for people sending out direct mail to raise money. They would then pick the high emotional items on which they could raise money. And then in terms of the extreme religious right, they began with the communism aspect. And this raised lots of money to be against communism. It helped the Reagan administration tremendously.
They say, we are left with the same overriding question. What does the fundamentalist right have against human beings? What grudge do they hold against the human mind, human feeling, and our capacity to choose? In their escape from humanity through high technology, would they turn us all into machines programmed by the scriptures? We cannot live as machines surrendered to Christ and computers, nor would the United States long endure as a fundamentalist nation. But neither can we survive as two nations, one fundamentalist and the other secular.
The Immortal Eve Libertine from Crass, 1981, from the album Penis Envy. Speaking of Penis Envy, let's listen to some lies Ronald Reagan told about that time during the campaign against Jimmy Carter. It's 462. Hit it, Mike.
I should like to begin by asking President Reagan, what would you do if, say, one afternoon you were advised that a race riot had broken out in Detroit?
Well, I would be inclined to say that that was a problem for the local authorities in Detroit, unless those local authorities were unable to control the situation and called in the federal government for martial help, such as troops. But otherwise, it really is a local problem, and maybe one of the things that's been happening too much is the federal government has been interfering where they haven't been invited in.
Yeah.
Well, when I was governor of California, it was in the roaring 60s when the campuses were in ferment and we were talking about long hot summers and there would be more cities burned and more rioting. Those were handled in the first place by local authorities, even in war-torn Berkeley, up to and including the county officials, the sheriffs, and so forth. Even the state was not involved until the local authorities, as they did one day calling from the university president's office, told me as governor that they could no longer assure the safety of the people of Berkeley, and they asked for the National Guard, and I immediately sent the National Guard in. I might do, in those cases, what the President of the United States did at that time with me. He did call me informally, having heard of the troubles we were having, and say, if at any time it becomes necessary or you feel it could be of help to have troops at the federal level, rest assured they'll be provided. But local law enforcement, and law enforcement is pretty much local. It isn't a federal problem to the extent of coming in because you hear there's been a crime committed in some city. And so here I understood my duty as governor that I did not send in the National Guard, nor should I, until I am asked by local authorities.
Well, would you encourage anyone at the federal level to inquire into the causes of the Detroit riot in case it proves that they might become endemic?
Ah, yes. Now that's a different thing. The cause of the riot, because in my view, the federal government has an obligation to enforce the Constitution, which means to protect the constitutional rights of all citizens. If the cause of the riot was the denial of constitutional rights to any group of citizens, I believe that, if need be, the federal government should protect those rights of even the least individual among us at the point of bayonet, if necessary.
And what if it was not a denial of constitutional right, but some aspect of deprivation, which isn't formulated in the Constitution? Would you feel a collective sense of responsibility that focuses in the White House leadership?
I think that you would keep in touch. I think that you would, at all times, make it evident to the local authorities that you stood by, ready to help. But until they felt the need for that kind of help, I think it would be undue interference of the federal government to move in.
Thank you.
Right, that was PJ Harvey out of the UK with comments by Ronald Reagan, lies by Ronald Reagan. Never forget COINTELPRO and Ronald Reagan. Never forget the chief of police of Oakland, California, when they were gunning down Black Panthers. Came out of military intelligence. At the same time, computerized policing came out of Kansas City. Lawrence Kelly from the FBI. They put $1 billion worth of squad cars and radar guns in one summer. So it's been nothing but counterinsurrection ever since. Now we're gonna do one more.
Carl.
Yeah.
Hey man, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
You know, those are old times. That's good times. Old and good times. I remember those days. I just wanted to ask for the listeners: was that William Buckley, that rat turd? Was that the voice?
Yes,
of
rat turd William Buckley. God and man at Yale. Yes, he defended. Yeah, and then he wrote a book defending Joseph McCarthy.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
He's one of these guys that invented a fake accent.
Yeah, right. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Back to the listeners.
Hi. This is. We're gonna let Howard Zinn clear the air here. All right, this is 476. Hit it, Mike.
This is absolutely nothing except the liberal media's tactics again. This is all it is. I watch this whole thing. I'm retired now. I watch the whole thing on TV. These journalists liberal media is so upset because this war went so well and they couldn't do just any and everything they wanted to. All they're doing now is bashing, bashing, bashing. That's all that they're doing. And just like they're doing with the White House Chief of Staff right now, they're all just piling on him now. They're so damn desperate to get something against George Bush or to make him look bad that they're even going after John Sununu now, which hasn't done a single thing, just trying to make George Bush look bad.
And in fact, if the president, well, this is what Clinton said in his last presidential campaign, he said, this is a quote, "The era of big government is over." Well, if you knew some history, you would know how absurd this statement was. You know, first of all, as if there were an era of big government, as if we hadn't had big government from the very, very beginning of this country. I mean, that's what the Constitution was about. The Constitution was set up to establish big government, to establish a strong government, a government that would do the work that slaveholders needed to be done, a government of that would control things, that would control things like Shays' Rebellion out in western Massachusetts, a government that would protect people who were moving out west to take over Indian land, a government that would take care of the bondholders. There's a long, long, continuous line of governments taking care of bondholders from the revolutionary period down to the present day. You'll know that that big government has existed in this country ever since the beginning of the Republic, that government was big in handing out enormous free grants of land to the railroads and tariffs to subsidize the manufacturers, in using the power of the government to protect employers against labor strikes, to put people like Eugene Debs in jail, to send the army out to take care of workers who are out on... I mean, the government has always been big in defense of the business interests, the corporate interests of the country. And it was only in the 20th century when, for the first time, the government began, under the impact of social movements, on the impact in the early 20th century of the Socialist Party and the IWW, and then in the 60s, under the impact of the movements of the 60s, when the government, pressured by these movements, began to pass reform laws in the 30s and the 60s, Social Security and unemployment insurance and subsidized housing, and then in the 60s, Medicare. Then, when for the first time the government began doing things to ordinary people, the people greatly needed, then the cry went up, big government. and a cry not only from the Republican Party, but a cry now from the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. which is shameful. So you'd have to know some history in order to be able to really think about what is being said to us by the people in power, and then to go out and look for yourself for sources of information that will widen your understanding and perhaps enable you to then join together with other citizens, because if you don't join together with other citizens to do something about what's going on in the world, you can't certainly depend on the people who are in power to take care of the injustices that exist or to make sure that we don't get into another war.
So let me tell you about what happened in Israel. An incredible thing happened to me. I'd gone there believing in Zionism and thinking this was a homeland for Jews. And then I got to have to basically counsel Jewish women who'd been raped by Jewish men. I also had to counsel Jewish women who'd been battered by Jewish men and Jewish girls who'd been raped by Jewish by their fathers. And I began to think, is this really a homeland for Jewish women? Because the same violence against women that goes on in other places goes on here. And then it kind of all coalesced one day. I'm walking down the main street in Tel Aviv, and there's a big porn image flapping in the wind, and it's a woman on her knees giving a man oral sex with Hebrew everywhere. And I thought, the last time a Jewish woman was shown publicly on her knees like that was probably in Nazi Germany, where they made pornographic images of Jewish women. And I went up to the guy and I said to him, I said, there's a law against this, and I'm now going to go to the police and I'm going to get you arrested. Of course, there was no law, right? So they just said that in the hope I'd get him to take it down. And he looks at me, this man. Now, this is a man who's never done women's studies, hasn't got a PhD in media, and he looks at me and he says to me, I know why you don't like that picture. He said, that's you, isn't it? That's you up there. And I thought, yes, you are absolutely right. Of course it's me. As a woman, of course it's me, because that's the reality of pornography. We're all up there, vulnerable and into pornographic gaze. So I went home and I started doing a sociology of media doctorate. And I approached pornography as one would approach any form of media, which is that, how do media images affect us? How do they impact on the world that we live in? And of course, anyone who's progressive politically talks about the role of the media in an unequal society, how the fact that a few have access to most of the resources, and how do we legitimize that? How do we normalize that through a media? And so what I began to realize when I was reading media studies was, you know, if people say images have an effect, if people say they construct reality, then surely pornography is going to do the same thing. Surely pornography is going to construct the reality of men. Because how can you walk away from these images unchanged? And as I always say, pornography delivers patriot ideology to men via the penis, which is an extremely successful delivery system.
Someone else's life.
That was The Cure from the Berlin Trilogy. Flat out getting it. The Cure was probably where Pink Floyd left off, The Cure picked up, in my opinion. And the Berlin Trilogy is proof of that. Now we're going to do another clip. We're going to do a radical thinker that's still alive to tell about it. He's got a book called Anarchism and the Black Revolution. Fourth edition has come out. And so this is an interview, a piece of an interview from Brian Knight from the UK, talking to Lorenzo Comboa Irving. And we'll pick up where he was on the run after he was accused of killing a Klansman. Who hasn't been there? Probably everybody in our audience has not been indicted for killing the Klansman at this time. So anyway, here's Lorenzo's story, and I think it's a good introduction to where he was coming from. This is 464. Hit it, Mike. Thank you.
I was in prison, actually, and I was serving two life sentences for hijacking a plane to Cuba. And I was a, you know, a revolutionary back in the 1960s. You know, there was nothing special about me, though. I mean, that was a revolutionary period. And but I'd gotten to the stage by 1969 that I was losing my faith in all the movements that had existed, as well as losing my faith in status communism or the ideas of state, you know, state-based movements, whether they were communists or non-communists for that matter. And so I and the black struggle had waned considerably by that time. And I had come to the point that I met Martin Sostre, and to talk with Martin Sostre, who was the best-known political prisoner in the world at that time. He was a black Puerto Rican, and in New York State. And I had met him. They brought me back to New York City and put me in the Federal House of Detention. So we used to talk on a long-term basis, actually, while I was there, talked every day. As long as we could be together, I would, you know, talk to him, and he would explain to me what anarchism was and, you know, gave me ideas on how I should deal with my case. He was concerned about the fact that back in those days, hijacking a plane was a capital crime. You know, you could have been sentenced to death. And he was very concerned about that and the fact that the case was in Georgia, you know, where there would be an all-white jury and I could be sentenced to death very easily. So he was concerned about these things. So we talked about this stuff all the time. And so he broadened my understanding and, you know, and radicalized my thinking. So that by the time, you know, years later, after I'd been in prison for some years, I'd gone through an extensive level of political education. It was self-taught political education, but nevertheless it was political education. And I understood the ideas of radicalism generally, as well as the particulars of anarchism, you know. And it wasn't immediately that I got the ideas of, you know, building an anarchist federation. That was years later. In fact, didn't happen until I got out. But the idea that there has to be an alternative to what existed at the end of the 1960s, when the movement was falling apart, and, you know, people were looking for alternatives. And for me, that alternative for me was anarchism, and not so much the groups that existed, as much as the ideas and the radical history. That was important, you know. And so it was years later that I actually wrote Anarchism and Black Revolution. 10 years after I'd been in prison, in fact, I'd done extensive thinking about it, you know. And so when I wrote it, it was written from the standpoint that the anarchist movement at that time was just a white movement. And it didn't speak to black people. And so I wrote a book that raised the contradiction of a movement that says it was a revolutionary movement, not dealing with the condition of oppressed blacks and other peoples of color, colonized peoples, you know, whether it was internal colonies in the United States and other countries, as well as on the continent of Africa. And so I was raising these contradictions in a way that extended the thinking in terms of anarchism to deal with black and other peoples of color. So that was a first in and of itself. That hadn't happened before. People try to act like, you know, anarchism was some group that had diversity or something. I don't know. It was not the fact. And in fact, I had a great deal of opposition from white anarchists by my raising this issue and then calling upon more black people to join the anarchist movement so that we can help to change it or help to build an internal alternative, you know. And that's what I've been doing all this time, ever since, you know, I wrote it, the original Anarchism and the Black Revolution. It's become more and more of a rallying cry for black activists, more than just trying to explain it to white anarchists why they should be forthcoming and open, you know, and open support for the movement, which they never have done. They've never been sympathetic to the idea of a black anarchist movement. And so we had to fight our way in to whatever we were able to do, you know, whatever formations we were able to build and all that we were able to do, we had to fight it. So the book was the battering ram, if you will, to deal with internal, what I call internal racism inside the movement, and this whole effort to prevent the rise of a black anarchist movement, which is going to come, is coming more and more. And, of course, I was one of the ones who created the first Black Anarchist Federation in 1994 in Atlanta, Georgia. So anarchism and the Black Revolution was just a step. It was the ideological foundation and framework for what came afterwards.
You know, as journalists were asking, don't African Americans have Second Amendment rights? And that's what sent me down this path all the way to the 17th century to be able to answer that question.
They killed my boyfriend. He's licensed. He's licensed to carry. He was trying to get out his ID and his wallet out his pocket, and he let the officer know that he had a firearm and he was reaching for his wallet, and the officer just shot him in his arm.
It was the killing of Philando Castile. You know, I start off the book going, you know, it was like a snuff film because we all saw that video image. And it was horrific. It was jarring. And to then get the backstory that this was a man who followed NRA guidelines. So he is killed because he has a weapon. Not that he is brandishing the weapon. Not that he is threatening anyone. He simply has a weapon. And that really led me to begin on this journey as I saw the NRA's virtual silence on this. On this journey to figure out, do African Americans have Second Amendment rights? You know, we're in this moment where the Second Amendment is like hallowed ground. It is sacred. It is one of those things that have been defined as the bedrock of citizenship. And so I started looking, and as I went on this journey, what I saw was that it wasn't about guns. It was about the fear of black people. It was about the fear of blackness. It was about the societal labeling of black people as dangerous, as a threat to whites, and that this architecture comes in place in order to contain this black population, in order to provide security and safety to the white community from this fear of black people. And you get this really weird matrix happening where black people are feared but needed. And so it is the how do we contain them? How do we snuff out their quest for freedom? How do we snuff out their quest for their basic human rights while also keeping them as labor without rights? How do we do that? How do we make that subjugation happen? How do we talk about in this land of the United States of America, how do we talk about freedom but try to keep it contained from this black population? We don't want them getting the ether that we're talking about in this revolutionary moment about freedom and democracy and justice. We don't want them hearing the words about equality. How do we do that? And when there was a revolt in Virginia in 1800 with Gabriel, and Gabriel had fed on the language, the revolutionary language from the United States, from the French Revolution, and from the Haitian Revolution, that sent shockwaves throughout the United States. And Virginia was trembling at the expansiveness of Gabriel's revolt. And the response was, you know, the wrong people are getting the word about freedom and democracy. The wrong people are hearing this revolutionary language and thinking that it applies to them.
Thank you.
Music by Thievery Corporation. Carol Anderson talks about Second Amendment rights for black folks. Lorenzo Gamboa Irving, Black Autonomy Federation, talking about the early years of his development. And we'll talk more about his involvement with SNCC when he was 13 years old. He was out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. And just an amazing story. And there's a lot to gain from anarchism in the Black Revolution. First edition copies are selling for like $400 on eBay when you can find them. So he's up there in years, and so he could no longer travel. But last time he went to Europe for 30 speaking engagements, they double booked him. So he did a lunch and a dinner, and he said he would go to the white areas of, you know, of Spain or somewhere, and it would be black people. He'd go to the black areas, and it would be white people come to see him. And so he said it was really an amazing trip. This has probably been six or seven years since he did that. But it's a great story. It's free online at Anarchist Library. He's got a book, The Progressive Plantation, and it tells about white saviors and just the whole pathology of non-governmental organizations. And of course, this, you know, the NGO come out of the Reagan Tax Act of 1986, and it literally destroyed the Rainbow Coalition. So it was an interesting time in the 70s, and I'm glad that we all shared that together. And so we still got stories to tell. So we're going to...
Over there on the island, Ginger Goodwin. We went over and put flowers on his grave. Fine and remarkable man. So let's try it. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're going to find a way, boys, for shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win the day, boys, where the Fraser River flows. Fellow workers, pay attention to what I'm gonna mention, for it is the clear contention of the workers of the world that we should all be ready, true-hearted, brave, and steady, to rally round the standard when the red flag is unfurled. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win the day, boys, where the Fraser River flows. All these gunny sack contractors have all been dirty actors. They're not our benefactors, each fellow worker knows. So we gotta stick together in fine or dirty weather, and we'll show no white feather where the Fraser River flows. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win the day, boys, where the Fraser River flows. Now the boss the law is stretching, bulls and pimps he's fetching, and they're a fine collection, as Jesus only knows. But why their mothers reared them, and why the devil spared them, are questions we can't answer where the Fraser River flows. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win a day, boys, with a razor.